Going into our last hour, Charles Ostman coming back with your questions, your comments. Join the conversation. We're talking about history of the future. That is to say, you know, the quote that that Charles Ostman is known for, what appears to be the future for many is already the past for some, and not and now unfolding into the present. Did I get that right? It's off the top of my head, which always hurts whenever I try to think about that. What appears to be the future for many is already the past for some, and are now unfolding into the present. And we'll pick at that as we talk to the historian of the future next. All hail King Nerd, Charles Ostman, next on Coast to Coast Live. So, Charles Ostman, before we get to this conversation that we've, I have anyway, delayed you from addressing the subject of spiritual intelligence and how it just might save us all, even from the perspective of science in a minute. Let me ask you, what's been more dangerous? What's more dangerous to the future of humankind, religion or science?
What a fascinating question to try to come up with. They could both be equally dangerous when misapplied.
See,
I'll toss at you a further thought.
Sure.
Many scientists that I know personally who are really good people, they try really hard to do what they think will be the best way to solve things
right.
like hunger and energy distribution and things that have to do with quality of life and medical stuff.
Right.
A lot of them actually are spiritual. They may not broadcast it in their academic circles because that could be a bit touchy with their different positions, but you'd be surprised how many actually are much more spiritual than you might imagine.
I don't think so. I wouldn't be surprised. Because I know a lot of scientists who also have a spiritual life or a faith life, but I'm going to change that a little bit. I'm going to say again, it's religion versus science.
Now religion is a much more delicate issue, and I know I'm going to offend somebody, so please forgive me. And I happen to be quite spiritual myself, but where I see religion going horribly wrong is when in certain situations it becomes this large, megalithic, kind of like a quasi-political engine, not so much based on the spirituality or the spiritual growth or the sort of health of the people ascending to maybe a better way of being, but it has a lot more to do with big money, big politics, big geopolitical interest, and a lot of people who I think are very well-meaning, who really believe and really want to do the right thing, but find themselves kind of wrapped up in a container that doesn't necessarily actually reflect those inner beliefs. And I think you're seeing a lot of that in today's religions, that people are rebelling. They're kind of, it's like a second reformation. They're kind of saying, wait a minute, we love the idea of worshiping a higher being, and we love the positive side of fellowship and helping our fellow man and charity, and those are all the things that we absolutely want to do. But we're not so hot on some of these kind of quasi-political, big sort of quasi-corporate sort of leanings that these religious systems are getting towards. And I think we're seeing a dividing line as we see.
Well, a part of what you said there just kind of also sounded like a description of NASA to me.
But in a certain sense, no, I see where you're going. It's okay. It's fair enough.
Yeah. But also, I mean, I think you're right, and I would agree, and I would say religious systems – any kind of system is inherently dehumanizing. Systems can't help but be dehumanizing because their focus is not on one-on-one service, but one on a thousand. And so, you know, you have to start looking at, you know, systems.
Where I see the toxicity, if I could be so bold, on both science and in religion. The toxicity threshold for me, at least, and this is just my personal view, and I'm happy to hear your alternative view. For me, it's where you're told to not question or to not offer alternative evidence, but just to blindly believe. I don't care if it's a scientific paradigm that says this is the truth and do not argue, or if it's a religious paradigm saying this is the truth and do not argue. Anytime I hear something like those words, my first response is, oh yeah? Well, there's nothing else that's going to inspire me to be extra diligent and probably find as many alternative reasoning or, you know, logical or evidence as I possibly can.
I think you're right, and I think that both academia and religion can be very brittle, and out of fear comes the resistance to any kind of challenge.
I'll tell you where I've seen the most severe an absolutely severe aspect of this in terms of science being rigid and like a religious system. And in fact, on Coast to Coast, much to this program's credit, with Art and yourself and with George and other hosts, every time you guys bring on some of these folks with some of their latest research into a different alternative anthropological bits of research about
right.
early human history or some of the archaeological relics that are now being discovered, and of course this doesn't bode well with the current science memes of the day. Believe me, that's probably the most extreme examples where you have these anthropology types and they're very, very preset, chisel and stone, sorry for the pun, ways of, this is the history, this is the art, this is how we've written the timeline, and do not argue. If you do, you'll be ostracized and probably lose your tenorship. I mean, that really is the case in this realm of science. And you know, other areas of science, perhaps less so, but in particular, this anthropological area. And this is what's so frightening, because I think that if we're going to have any chance at all, even a slim one, of progressing past this sort of next evolutionary challenge threshold, which is just a handful of years away, we have to learn as much as we possibly can, all the good and the bad, but importantly, the truth of what we have done in the past is our best shot at figuring out how we're going to work the future.
Well, and so I guess in the past, then I'll ask you, has science ever said no?
I think that science has been told to say no, and it simply pops up somewhere else.
Yeah. So science, but has science ever said no? Not the government says you can't.
Probably the closest we came was when the first nuclear test was being done in New Mexico, and some of the very best minds in the world, including Albert Einstein himself, said, this could be a really iffy thing. We might set fire to the entire atmosphere. we really don't know what's going to happen here.
And they still did it.
Well, but the reasons were very compelling, because had we gone, and people, of course, will probably call and yell at me, but this is how I see it. And I've studied this history pretty well. I have a lot of friends who are actually sort of part of that background, so I can kind of comment a little
right.
bit. We were looking at an all-out, no-holds-barred, probably 2 million-plus casualties on both sides if we went into Japan on land
right.
with guys in tanks
right.
and boots. And
island for
it would have been one of the worst nightmares probably in
sure.
all of human history. And horrible as it was, the calculation was made that if this is what it takes to bring this thing to an end, to get everybody to say, okay, we've had it, let's put a stop to this, it was the best thing we could work with at the time. I mean, it was a very tough decision. I'm not saying it was right or wrong. I'm just saying it was the decision that was made under extreme conditions.
Well, I get that. But, I mean, here's Albert Einstein, who blows the bell curve for the planet. He says, hey, this might light all of our atmosphere on fire and end life as we know it. And science still said yes. I ask you again, has science ever said of its own accord, looking at what's on the table, looking at the models in the computer, whatever, and said, you know what? Nah, let's not do this one.
Actually, I would say that in some areas of biology, that's probably being done now. In other words, I think that there are some really tough debates going on. I've had an earful of people debating some of these things as we speak. I mean, believe me, when I toss out these things about artificial organisms and all this kind of
right.
stuff, it's not that this is being done willy-nilly, pie in the sky, oh, let's all have a good time making billions of dollars off of patenting some organism. Believe me, it's not like that at all. It truly is not. But, again, it's kind of like World War II in Japan. We're looking at an unbelievably complicated set of situations. World hunger, starvation on a scale that can't even be
right.
imagined. Famine, disease, new epidemics breaking out that we are simply unequipped to deal with because we don't have the medicines or the antibiotics to even begin to deal with them. How are we going to wrestle with this? How are we going to somehow have a different set of tools to work with where the current tools aren't going to work at all? I mean, that's kind of what we're looking at. So, I mean, extreme circumstances require some extreme responses. That's kind of the balancing point.
If science has never said no, why would they ever say no in the future?
Well, here's, again, this is kind of where I come at this. If you have a group of folks that sit down and say, this is it. We're not going to do this. This is wrong. It's just not going to happen. Sorry, it doesn't work that way because somewhere else in the world, somebody else is going to pop up out of the noise floor and they're going to have an entirely different agenda, a completely different way of looking at the world, a very different spiritual path perhaps, where the very things that you and I would be horrified at and say, oh my God, we can't be doing this, this is craziness, might be completely logical and within reason, in fact, a calculated risk from their perspective. That's the challenge. There is no homogenous, contiguous fabric of thought where everybody's on the same page. In fact, as we speak, the thing that really scares me is that there's such a severe difference between different philosophical realms out there, where even an attempt to have a kind of a quasi-homogeneous way of looking at something that would affect the entire planet. I mean, if we can't even figure out that we're going to agree to maybe even slightly maybe curb, you know, our change to the climate due to industrial activities or whatever, if we can't even do that, then trying to approach this kind of a problem is, you know, many orders of magnitude of a larger scale. So, I mean, that's like an example of exactly the quandary you're in.
Whereas the scientists, these very smart people, get together and they have these conversations amongst their very smart friends, and then they talk about what it is they're going to do, these are decisions which could affect huge percentages of the population.
Oh, yeah, no question about it.
Right.
And they don't ask. Well, and not to sound too technical or cold, but in a weird kind of way, and I know that this goes back to the very first 5 minutes when we first went on the air together, I kind of blurted out this rather harsh but crisp scenario that said, look, if we continue to sort of go down the path that we're on, you know, unchecked population growth, depletion of the planetary resources, perpetual increase of the damage we're doing to our climate and so on, then at a certain threshold point, the system's going to kind of correct itself. And in fact, one of those correction points would be exactly this, some kind of clumsy biological invention that was maybe meant for something of a good purpose, but somebody else got their hands on the same stuff and had something very different in mind. Some idiot that wants to do a religious war or whatever, you know, and spawns this evil stuff, and then it kills off 2/3 of the population. In the larger scheme of things, maybe that's the way it's supposed to work out, because we simply could not come together in a more peaceful way to solve the same set of problems.
And I want to take that same example, and I'm not being an apologist for religion, you know.
No, it's okay.
Take the sins of the world and double them in the church. I'm totally good with that. But when you threw in there some religious organization, why not the self-correcting planet theory? Why not just the fact that some scientist somewhere said, hey, I've got the funding to do this. We've always wondered what happens when we put tab A into slot B.
That's probably not the – since I live in this sort of academic world, I don't see that motivation. It's just not that way.
Maybe some
obscure part of the planet, there's some nutcase out there that thinks that way. But it's really not like that. I mean, I have to really stress this point. However, I think what could happen, and I think what's very realistic, I didn't mean to be overly – zealous in the anti-religion part. That's not where I'm coming from at all.
No, I get that. I'm not
my thing. But that seems like one of the possible vectors. But one of the other possible vectors could be a well-meaning but hopelessly, but horribly misguided group of folks could say, like these sort of Illuminati types, as some people call them, their vision is, you know, we got to change the world because we got to change it. The world's going to self-destruct. So, you know, we're going to take it upon ourselves to decide that certain populations in the planet, well, they're not needed anymore. It's just, sorry, but that's just the way it goes. So, I mean, in their own particular scientific, quasi-scientific, I use that word very, very delicately here, and their sort of technical rendition of how to manage the planet of the future in current terms so they can, in a sense, reorganize the planet to what they see as a more optimum situation, they may decide to craft some sort of horrible mutagenic disease that wipes out 2/3 of the population as a calculated process to bring the planet to a more manageable state of being. I mean, I could see where a group of folks would actually sit down and maybe reason that out. Not driven by religion, but maybe driven by a much more kind of geopolitical, kind of technical perspective. I mean, both sides could be equally horrible.
I guess I was looking at sort of like the law of unintended consequences, that suddenly, you know, what scientists thought were going to get effect A, which was what they were being paid to and or had the funding to try to develop, actually ends up being consequence B, which ends up being devastating. Kind of like the Monsanto B scenario. There's no religion involved.
The Monsanto example is a particularly horrible one. And in fact, one person I'd like to aim you towards, because he's a really good person to have this, he'd be a great guest, by the way, if you ever get him on, would be Leroy Hood. He's the founder of the Systems Biology Institute up in Seattle, Washington. Very smart guy. This is exactly his thing. This is precisely what he spends his life working on, are these kinds of problems. He's one of the smartest guys you could ever talk to, and he's a scientist with a very serious genetic engineering sort of biotech background, and it's this kind of thinking that he tries to work through in his institute. And this is the way it works. As you go up this ladder of complexity and scale and diminishing timelines, the risk gain ratio also increases. It's just like gambling. It's like being at Reno or Las Vegas, and you go for the larger crapshoot or whatever. I don't know, gambles, I don't know what the term is, but I mean, you go for the larger poker hand or something. But I mean, the point is, that's how this tends to work. And You're right. I mean, if we try to play it safe and go to where nothing of unintended consequences would be of such a catastrophic nature that it would not harm the whole planet, or, you know, we'd have to go back to a very different time, which we simply can't do. So we have to kind of work with what we have.
Either that or, and I think there's a place for, and science has never wanted to do this, and I don't think it's because they think that they're so much smarter that they shouldn't have to ask the masses. But I think that there may be a kind of hierarchy in that sort of thinking that says, us smart kids in the class, we'll figure it out and everybody else will thank us later. I wonder sometimes whether this technology actually, there's a moral imperative to the development
of
these technologies.
I know where you're going with this. And here's my thought. There's a very interesting guy named Jerry Glenn, who I've known for many years. He actually has something called the Millennium Institute in Washington, D.C. He's actually spoken at a number of my events in the past. And this is exactly what his whole thing is. In fact, his idea was to have kind of like a, and this is a very, very bad metaphor, but something like a United Nations of science, where you'd have a planetary collection of top echelon science people who could bring these ideas out to the public forum so that from a sort of a quasi-political, maybe commercial perspective, these things could be weighed and evaluated, and some kind of decision or the deciding body could determine what should be pushed forward, what should perhaps be put back on the shelf. The problem with that, however, is how do you enforce this? In other words, well, two things. First of all, you have to have a whole lot of people out there, ordinary folks, to suddenly take an interest in this and actually study the issues. Now, I say this again very delicately. I'm not in any way trying to castigate other folks out there, but when you look at sort of garden variety, say, political issues, you know, when people go to vote and they read their ballots and so on, even in today's world, the vast majority of political decisions quite often are based on kind of ephemeral, you know, sort of soundbite sales pitch kind of drivers.
Right.
That's politics. Now, imagine trying to apply that process to something as complex as the stuff we're talking about now. Can you imagine this really happening? I'm just asking you the question. Is that
You know what I can imagine? I can imagine Monsanto saying, hey, we want to have genetically engineered seeds that will fundamentally change the way plants are pollinated.
Yeah,
and
well,
we don't think there's any.
I'm with you on this one. In other words, what you're saying is the examples we're already seeing. And if it turns out that because of that particular paradigm that the bees are being killed off and so on, I mean, this could be the positive side. This could be that if this really turns out to be the case, it would be just the kind of precedent that might require, or in other words, instigate a kind of a governing body to take a global perspective on how science is managed. Again, the only drawback, and I'm not discouraging, I mean, I think your idea is fine. I'm actually with you on this one. I mean, Jerry Glenn and myself have had these ideas for years. But again, what we come back with is how do you actually get this to be looked at and obeyed or agreed to by the majority of the world's industrial entities? And the question is it possible? Because, you know, no matter how well-intentioned this kind of a body might be put together, I can assure you from day one, there's probably going to be insiders lobbying to get their stuff through, and there's going to be all kinds of political intrigue and
sure.
bribes. And, I mean, in other words, this is the failure play of the human condition. Folks like ourselves can have a chat and decide this might be a better way, but realistically, how does it actually map against a template of human behavior as we know it to be? That is
the
question.
And the scientists could just say no.
I would hope, at a certain point, most of the people I know, at least personally, if they thought something was really, truly questionable, they would stop. But I'm only speaking for the people I know personally, so I can't speak for the entire scientific body. It's true.
I forgot we were actually in a segment where we were going to take callers. So hang on. We'll get to the phones coming up next. We'll shoot you the numbers if you missed them. Charles Ostman, our guest, and we will talk about spiritual intelligence next, Coast to Coast Live. This is Ian Punnett. And several people hanging on for Charles Ostman. We'll get to them right away, as we will also wrap up the show with what you need to know about spiritual intelligence that could save your life, or at least make it a lot less boring in the future. The future as Charles Ostman sees it, next on Coast to Coast Live. This is Ian Punnett. All right, Mike in Maryland, west of the Rockies, for Charles Ostman on Coast to Coast Live. Mike, thanks for your patience.
Hey, guys, this is my first time ever calling this program, and I have a question, but first I have a comment. It's probably one of the best conversations that I've ever been privy to.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's the whole thing.
My question is, in the biblical sense, is this man acting as his creator in the term of being a creator, creating life, or is it in our arrogance, our technological Tower of Babel?
I would offer a third view, if I may. We are God's creation. There is something out there larger than us. There is. I'm not one to get into a scriptural debate, but having looked at the universe and having looked at the nano world and everything between, it's not just a bunch of random stuff thrown together. I'm certainly going to walk that path. I would also agree that there's a kind of a larger set of dimensions that we're being prepped or trained to become cognizant of. That's where I was trying to go with spiritual intelligence. I want to answer Mike's question, if I may. My third response would be, or the third option is this. We are God's creation, but we're allowed the tools of free will. In that context, we are allowed the tools to create, to utilize the resources around us to, in a sense, enhance our capacity to continue to flourish and evolve past a certain point. In other words, we're not designed to be static. We're designed to continue to grow and evolve and adapt and become different over some length of time. We're given a set of tools to work with. How we choose to use those tools, that's where the debate could come in. But the fact that we have crossed the line and made an artificial life form, or the fact that we've shown that that the universe is 13.5 billion years old, or the fact that we can verify that gravity waves in fact exist, or the fact that we've begun to tap into the worlds of quantum consciousness as a definable thing, this isn't violating the precepts of spiritual vision. It's actually enhancing it. In other words, that's the one point that I might, in a very graceful and polite way, suggest you might want to re-examine this logic form, because I often have this debate where people say, well, if we're stepping in this territory, we're somehow, violating God's precepts, or we're becoming God. No. We're simply adapting to a different set of tools. It was what was actually part of the larger design strategy.
Mike, go ahead. I know you were trying to follow up there, Mike.
Oh, absolutely. When you think of all the years in human history, I just find it amazing that we're alive in this very time, a pivotal crossroads.
Absolutely. It is astonishing. And one thing I might agree with you on, if you want to walk this path a little bit further, I find it extremely interesting that in dozens of cultures all over the planet on five continents, whether it's Judeo-Christian or Upanishads or Mayan calendar, or Pacific Islander, you can pick any culture you wish, they all more or less recognize, roughly within this time frame, about now or a few years from now, something of a truly dramatic or perhaps transformative nature was going to occur about now. There is something special about this moment in time. Now, some scriptural references talk about an Armageddon and a very, dire kind of a separation, and the chosen ones get to go somewhere else. I'm not sure I buy all that, but I do certainly find it extremely interesting that something of a tremendous magnitude was shown to be occurring about this time. That is interesting, and we are alive now to see it.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate that. But let me say, you just said something that I thought contradicted what you said earlier about the idea of chosen ones. And yet we started this conversation with this idea of cosmids and therons.
Wait a minute. When I said chosen ones, that was a reference to a scriptural edict that says those who believe this word will now be the ones who get to go somewhere else. No, that's not what I was – that's absolutely not what I was trying to suggest at all.
That's not what – that would be one way of thinking about it. The other way is that some people are just – will be chosen. And then there will be some people, by no virtue of anything they've done that's great or whatever is, they'll be shown the promised land and others won't.
In a larger context, I would agree that statistically speaking, not by some carefully crafted design strategy or by some rote, appliance or application of religious edict, but just by the fact that statistically some folks will be on one side and some folks will be on the other. I would certainly go with you there. I'll go that far.
Let's get to Floyd Wildcard Line. He's in Texas on Coast to Coast Live for Charles Ostman. Floyd?
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. I can see the front door of Clear Channel Communications right across the street.
How about that? I have 95 theses I'd like for you to tap up on their door, but we'll talk about that later.
Well, the last caller talked about this being a crossroads. There's a crossroads every night choosing between Coast to Coast and Jim Bohannon, but I always go for Coast to Coast, so that's,
well, see,
that's a good crossroad.
That shows you're highly enlightened, although Jim Bohannon's a very nice guy to me whenever I see him. He never remembers my name, but he's a very nice guy.
But he's never had any gray aliens on the show, though, so
that's true.
His downfall. But, you know, you were talking about the group, the kind of grungy group that stays on the earth and the enlightened group that goes.
Well, I didn't mean it quite that way. That was kind of more of Ian's way of looking at it. But what I was hoping to get to was the sense that there is a separation occurring, not by design, but just as it's happening, where it's access to a different existence pattern, and that existence pattern over time will, in fact, lead to something that's very different than those who are not part of that process.
Well, I would suggest that you may have come up with the concept from H.G. Wells' Time Machine, where they had the grungy ones were called the Morlocks.
Oh, yeah, and the Eloi. The Eloi were the food. I know the story backwards and forwards.
The Morlocks, the women of the Morlocks look sort of like Fred Thompson, and the men look like Bigfoot, you know.
I'm not sure I want to go that far, but I mean, that was one very, very severe depiction where the Warlocks went underground and sort of like ate the Eloi.
Yeah.
And as Ian often talks about tasty Canadians, okay, well, you know, there could be some spread about there. But.
Well, the women women of the Eloi look sort of like Britney Spears, and the men look sort of like Tom Cruise type of thing, you know.
You've been thinking about this a lot, Floyd. I think you've been doing some casting. Let me grab a couple of the callers, but I appreciate what you're saying. It was very fun. Sonny is in Orlando, appropriately enough, east of the Rockies on Coast to Coast Live. Go ahead, Sonny.
Hi, this is Sonny, and I've been listening to the show for a couple of years, and I really do enjoy a lot of the topics on Coast to Coast.
Thank you. Glad to have you.
Now, I've been thinking about this bee thing for a while, and I just wanted to say it was quite a few years ago, they had a bunch of frogs up in Minnesota that turned out, mutated, and a lot of people thought that it was the ozone, and it actually turned out to be high levels of estrogen, I believe, in the water from birth control.
Yeah, well, I think they're still working on it, but yeah, I mean, I live here, and that's one of the running theories on the mutations.
One thing I might blurt out just as an aside to maybe kind of go along with what the caller's saying, I don't know precisely, and I'm not sure anyone knows exactly what the single most prodigious mutagen is in this process. It may be a collection of mutagens. But here's what's interesting. Frogs and amphibians are like the canary in the coal mine. Because they live in an aqueous environment, their skin, their whole respiratory process is an extremely sensitive indicator of, and even the smallest toxicities or changes in the environment very quickly and at the first, you know, beginning edge of a process that's taking place, they're the indicators. So when you see frog populations dying off or being born with weird, like six legs or something, and, you know, strange configurations, it's an indicator that something has gone very wrong. I mean, that in itself is an indicator worthy of note.
But, Sonny, you had a quick thought you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, well, I noticed, you know, for the last few years, actually, and since the bees are pretty much the same as frogs, very sensitive, I was thinking that with all the antidepressants they've been pushing, could we be going in that same area? You know, if that's in the water, then...
In the water supply.
And the bee colony is actually being broken down, not dying off. They're being socially destroyed.
That's a great theory. It's very novel. I give you credit for originality. It's not one that I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer, but I'll say this much. I think that the more direct answer might be... I mean, I'm really taking a very close look at this idea of these seeds that are being forced upon the farmers, and they're being forced to use non-pollinizing crops, and that, I think, could have a very specific driver to changing the bee behavior. Other folks have talked about the changing of light, and in fact, I have a bunch of friends of mine who work at the Space Sciences Lab, which is literally like a mile from where I live, and these are astrophysicists who specialize in studying the sun, and what they've been noticing is that not only is the sun's activity really heating up, and I mean, in a very interesting way that nobody fully understands, but the color of the sun's light is changing. And in fact, if you take a quick look at some of the NASA outtakes recently, you'll find that all the planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Mars, are heating up, and they're also demonstrating a lot of electrical activity that they haven't seen before. And so one concept was that the ultraviolet content is changing, and the bees use ultraviolet as their way to navigate. And if that's changing, if they can't see where they're going or they can't see the pollen as they're trying to deal with it, that would have a tremendous effect on their ability to pollinize.
We did a whole show on that actually here about a year and a half ago about what the scientists refer to as global brightening.
Yeah, exactly.
And the first person to observe that, at least in the chain of events that led to a guest on the show, was an emailer who was a photographer who said, all of the magic light is disappearing. That light the photographers love at dawn and dusk.
I remember that. In fact, that's exactly right. In fact, nature photographers who for years had a very specific sense of the palette of the sky, as it were.
Right.
So it was changing. I remember that.
Very freaky. First time caller line, Gregory's got a question or comment for Charles Osman on Coast to Coast Live. Gregory?
Well, there are a million things I can ask, but number one thing, have you thought about the impact of the single human being through the internet and how through YouTube or a blog, how one single person now can kind of push or change the course of all of humanity? Because how we're all linked together now, and one person who's fairly insignificant now can post a thought that catches momentum and can turn so much. And what does that do as far as governments and control? Because now they have to deal with these throngs of informed people.
Well, actually, you've articulated in a certain kind of way the very essence of chaos theory. And a lot of the talks that I've given, which are much more sort of technical and mathematically oriented, but the general concept is that when things get more tightly coupled, there's something in mathematical theorems called collision theory. And believe me, it's not something you want to read. It's a very thick, complicated thing. But the basic idea is that things tend to cluster. There's what's called clustering phenomena as an artifact of collision theory. And things tend to flock together, and the more tightly they're coupled, then if you throw in even the smallest chaotic influence, then the whole system kind of reverberates, or this propagation wave kind of propagates the whole system. And the more tightly coupled, the faster acceleration of the wave and all that kind of stuff. But the whole point is that you're 100% right. We are living in a time now where everything's interconnected simultaneously at all times in real time.
Right.
This is the largest cultural transition ever known in history. There's nothing like it to be compared with. And so, in fact, this is what I was trying to describe to Ian a bit earlier, where if you're going to have something as complex as these kinds of very, very interesting but challenging sort of scientific versus sort of ethical questions on how do you debate these things, and yet you're mapping it against a chaotic system where anybody, you know, Britney Spears' kid sister or something, decides to throw a chaos element in the system and suddenly throws the whole system in some weird direction you didn't expect. Yeah, that's exactly what we're witnessing. I mean, it really is an interesting phenomenon, but you
Gregory,
captured it pretty well.
I appreciate that, and that leaves us time for a little bit more of a discussion on this idea of what might save us all, spiritual intelligence. Put more flesh on the bones on that.
Okay, flesh on the bones, and maybe a T-Rex drumstick if we're lucky. Here's how I see it to be, and this is my own clumsy way. And if you have a better way, maybe in a more of a theological setting, believe, I'm happy to hear your version, but this is how I see it. I think that when we have been visited from time to time, and Jesus Christ, when he walked on this planet, may have been a wonderful example of this. I mean, I've tried to understand what he was doing when he was here. He was trying to tell us something very important, and this is my clumsy way of interpreting this. He was saying, look, there's a larger scheme to things. The things that matter the most are compassion, a view of the world as a whole, not to be trapped in these little boxes of isolation and competition and greed and avarice, but to take an entirely different way of looking at the better path, not just to survive, but to actually flourish, to, as he would put it, go to a higher kingdom. And, you know, later in organized religious systems, people developed these complicated models. Really, it's more like a political system. But I think his model was really simple. He was saying, in essence, there is a different way to be, but you have to be willing to see this before you can understand what it consists of. I mean, this is, like, really simplistic, but that's kind of how I see it to be. So now we're being, and he was kind of warning us in a way. He was saying, look, in today's world, you know, back in the days of the Roman Empire, okay, things are still kind of large and isolated, and, you know, there will be all kinds of conflicts and wars and horrible things, but at a certain point, we're going to be pushed to a sort of an edge where we're going to have to learn to see this better spiritual way of being, or it'll be the end of us all. It'll be truly the demise of the world as we know it to be. And I think it was that from which the concept of Armageddon and that sort of thing came about. But I think that's what spiritual messengers have been trying to tell us, and I think there are others that came to this world as well. He is perhaps the one that's most known to us in the Western culture, but, I mean, I think that's the essence of it. If we can't see the sort of holographic picture of how we fit together into a larger framework, then we're toast. I don't care what kind of technology we invent. It's not going to work because we don't have the capacity to recognize its value and how to apply it correctly.
You could sum it up by saying the message at that time was that we need to change the table order of the world, and if you don't change it yourself, it will be changed for you.
Roughly speaking, I'll go with that. That's close enough. I think that's a reasonable summation.
So then that brings us down to last two questions in the time that we have. First would be, what would you recommend that people read right now order to prepare themselves for these paradigm shifts? Because if you're talking about the year 2025,
yeah.
For some of these crossroads of future history, I don't know. You got to be ready for that.
Yeah, well, actually 2012, according to some, maybe. I mean, it depends on who you want to talk
right.
to. But, you kind of caught me off guard. It's the one thing I did. I mean, I've got zillions of notes, and I'm trying to, at the top of my head in the last 30 seconds, partly asleep already. I'm sorry, but I'll gladly post to you later, maybe an email with a handful of books, and then at your leisure, you can just post them on the site or something.
Okay.
I just don't have anything that would say it's the best. I don't want to say, here's one book, and then at the exclusion of five others. I'd like to compose a bibliography and then send that to you later, if I could.
Okay, I'll do that. I'll take that. And then I'll ask you an easier question, a real Wait. Softball here, but it's still fascinating nonetheless. If you were able to pull out soft tissue from a T-Rex bone that surrendered T-Rex DNA, and a la Jurassic Park, you were going to inject that into something to see what would happen. Would you rather inject the T-Rex DNA into a chicken, the offspring of a chicken, or the offspring of a frog?
No comment. I don't have an answer. My brain is fried. What passes for neurons are pleading for mercy at this point. I think what's interesting, though, is that here's one thing that I find really scary, and this might be a closing note. I know that a couple of years ago, there were frozen remnants of what was a genetic signature of bubonic plague being dug out of the ice. It's a long story, but you probably read about this.
Right.
Now, the theory was if we could extract this and then develop a vaccine, wonderful. On the other hand, should we actually be doing this? That would be a really good question, and it's just the kind of thing I think should be questioned.
And so we'll leave it there on the question, and we'll just say thanks again, Charles Ostman, for doing everything you can to get us to be thinking more about what our current decisions will mean for our future selves. And thank you for coming back after last week and bouncing back so strong and for the extra time you surrendered at the beginning of the show.
All right.
And look forward to having you back on again. Keep us posted. Look forward to that email coming up. Thank you to everybody else who tried to get through. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. If you're on the East Coast, good luck with these storms coming. Keep your cap on. Don't panic. We'll get through it. It's Coast to Coast Live, Deus Te Amat, and I do too.